Hello and welcome. You're listening to Adventures in the Veil, an RPG discussion podcast. I'm Jake.
I'm Ross.
Sit back and relax by the fire, for there are tales to be told.
Cozy Crow, come and sit by our fire. May I get you something to drink?
Yeah. I'll take an ale.
I'll have that right out.
Welcome to the Adventures in the Veil Tavern Cast. My name is Ross. Here at the Tavern Cast, we talk about folk tabletop role-playing games. I'm joined again by my friend Jake.
That is me. I am he.
Yep. Jake, what's up? It's been a while.
I was thinking we could go, the troll that's been mentioned a few times.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I know where it is. If you want to go with me, we can go get that troll.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, because I said several months ago, I said I'm going to take that bounty, we took the paper off the board, and we're going to go get the bounty on the troll. Unfortunately...
I drew a little mustache on it, you know.
Yep. I remember that. Good times. I unfortunately don't know if you noticed, but there is a adventuring supply shortage in town. The adventuring store has a shortage of torches. And Caltrop, so
we could hire that cleric and get that cleric to cast light for us. That'd be fine.
Yeah, I don't know if that works with my alignment, though. You know, and besides, I just I'll get some torches. We'll work it out. But yeah, right now, unfortunately, there's a shortage in adventuring supplies. But anyways, what kind of adventures have you been on lately? Solo gaming, campaign, whatever.
I've actually been on a couple adventures. First of all, I'm running my city crawl in Shadowdark. Although I'd say it's Shadowdark light, roleplay heavy. I think that's kind of the way my game is. But
yeah.
I got that going. As far as other endeavors, I've been working on my system for my setting. Which is still under development, but right now I am working on that, and it's pretty nice. I think I'm going to steal a lot of rules from Runehammer's Crown and Skull, particularly the initiative phase system, where each player picks a phase and they act in that phase, and it's just five phases, and then at the end of the phase it's a round and starts back over. It's really simple. Nice and neat. Sometimes monsters act in a certain phase, sometimes they act in multiple phases, and just taking that little nugget of goodness and applying it to my world makes initiative so much easier, and I'm like, yes, we'll do that.
Yeah.
I like a lot about Crown and Skull, but there's something specific I wanted to tell in my setting, and not all the rules do that, because, you know, Crown Skull is its own thing, and it has its own motif and its own ethos that it's carrying with it, and I like that, but that's just not what I needed in my world, so in my game. So I've just taken that little thing and little nugget of goodness and added it in, but I've been developing that, and I think next week we're actually going to playtest that, so I'm excited about beginning the playtesting methodology and seeing that through. That's what I'm excited about. What about you?
Oh, cool. Yeah. I'm going to ask you questions about all that stuff. But, we've had a bunch of stuff going on. We did an actual play, a kind of little short tasting of Trollord Games' Castles and Crusades. And that was neat. You know, Trollord Games... they have secured the rights to a lot of Gary Gygax's works, and some of it's getting released for the first time, and so that was fun. I've always been curious about it. We've got Traveler, Classic Traveler, going on, And I don't know what else to say except it's the Firefly dream game for me. It's like it is Firefly, yeah. And we're doing the Fireflying, and that's exactly what I wanted. And we got original D&D Swords and Wizardry on Mondays, and the last session. So they're very high level. I would call them high level. They're about, so it goes to level 10, and one person I think is level 6.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they've been playing for a year and a half, and they are in the, some would say, most lethal mega dungeon ever made, Rapanothic, right? And so far, this thing, they have evaded every one of its traps. For a year and a half, they have secured treasure from this thing, and it hasn't killed them. And they spoilers for anyone who's playing in Rapanothic, I suppose, maybe skip ahead two or three minutes. But they found a way. Well, first of all, they made it to this level of teleport, like rooms that were all disconnected, and they teleported accidentally to like the far end, like 60 miles away, in the middle of a blizzard. And so they're lost, and they're cut off from, they can't get food or water or anything. So they had to delve down into Rapanothic. And I don't make any plans for any of this stuff. This is just what happened. They just got on the teleport pad, ended up 60 miles away, and they go down into the dungeon. And so they're trying to find their way home, and they're trying to survive. So there's all this tension. And they get a couple of levels down into Rapanothic trying to find a way across and make it back to their sanctuary. And they find some stairs that go into a cave, and they discover a beast, a purple worm. If anybody knows what one of those are, it's like the thing from Dune, the big giant worm, except purple. That's
or Tremors, right? Tremors is another one.
Yeah, huge monster, and even at like halfway to max level in Swords and Wizardry, absolutely no match for this thing. They had captured some in. They went to a fairy festival several months ago, and they got a bunch of like magic items from the fairies. Because they entertained the fairies and danced and did a bunch of stuff. And one of them was a magical circlet that randomly casts like an almost max level druid spell, and you don't know what the spell will be. And so as they're running from the purple worm, the magic user is like, wish me luck, and like activates the circlet. And it's this spell where you can become microscopic and jump into plants. And then and you can travel among all the plants nearby as this microscopic thing inside the plants. And he jumps into a mushroom, and then he spends like half the session. I have to jump back and forth between the group and him because they get away from the purple worm. And meanwhile, he's in a mushroom network trying to figure out what the dungeon is like within like 6,000 feet in every direction.
Oh, jeez.
That was weird.
So before we get away from the spoilers of the game, was the worm like predetermined, like they were in the worm's lair, or was it a random roll that you just happened to roll?
It's
a worm?
It's in the lair of the purple worm on the level, but there's a chance, and this is very common in original D&D modules or classic D&D modules, it'll say there is a 10% chance that the worm is currently present, and I rolled it.
Nice.
10%.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good time. I like it whenever I have a lair and then the monster's not there. It informs so much about what's going on. Like, yeah. Oh, it is hunting.
Yeah. He like traveled along the mushroom network 6,000 feet in different directions, and he found an evil temple of chaos where there was this whole room of ogres, like a whole army of ogres, and then he cast a spell that in original D&D you can craft your own spells. And he created a spell called Magnus's Minor Misconstruence. It's glorious. And it creates like a conflict between creatures because they start to misunderstand each other.
Oh, nice.
And he cast it on the ogres, and he created an ogre war, and they murdered each other in the Chaos Temple, and then he fled away, and it's just crazy. Wonderful. Yeah, it's nuts.
It's great.
Oh, man.
If you were skipping for spoilers, you can start listening now.
Yeah. yeah, so good times. We also have our Wednesday game, which we're finishing our campaign tomorrow. So there's also that.
Yeah, no spoilers for that, please.
Yeah. speaking of that, so back to your city crawl campaign. You picked Shadowdark, and what do you think of it so far? Like, why did you pick it, and what do you think?
I picked it because it's D&D light.
It's just like a light D&D.
Yeah, it's as far as like most stuff goes. The torch rules are interesting and add tension, which is nice. I like the way it took me a second to get used to it, but I like the way the monsters are abbreviated. Makes it a lot easier, and that's nice. The one thing that I didn't care for is the carousing rules. I like the idea of the carousing rules. This idea of spend gold for extra XP. Like, I love that idea. It's just like an instantaneous effect, and then but the tables are really weird and oddly specific, and they disconjointed with my setting and the type of game that I wanted to present. So I haven't used them, and it makes me sad because I think that's a core part of what Shadowdark is and like what it tries to be. So I don't think I've actually dove into Shadowdark or played like a raw version of Shadowdark. In fact, our Wednesday night game where I play your Shadowdark game is not Shadowdark at all. In fact, it's a very heroic version of Shadowdark called Herodark, and I love that. That's a lot of fun. So I haven't really got to play Shadowdark by the book. Although I can imagine what that would be like, and it seems fun. But the games that I run tend to not be so, I don't want to say lethal, because it's not lethal, but deadly, I guess.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
Punishing, I guess is the word. I don't like to run such punishing game systems. That's the reason I never really got into OSC. But although I do still want to try DCC, I think that's might be my next endeavor after I get over my little homebrew hiatus here.
Yeah. You know, as a player in your game, I feel like I can speak for the other players. I know what you mean, like there's this game master side, because Shadowdark actually has a lot of rules. So there's like rules for how you would do an overland thing, and when you would roll when you're in a city, and how often you would roll, and what encounters. You really have like a lot of stuff there to actually use. But on the player side of it, it is Shadowdark. You know, I'm using the spells from the book. I have my character. I roll my hit points. And I think everybody's having a great time just with that, right? Like I like the spells and, you know. And it's like you said, you know, you can execute a fairly simple game of Dungeons & Dragons, it seems like. That's what it feels like as a player, anyway, in your game. I think that I think the other two people in the game, I think they seem to feel that way. Like they're like, I got my character, I got my spells. It gives you all that stuff, right? Like it gives you your D&D stuff, but it's not like onerous and all the math you have to do all the time, and it's not like trying to fill out taxes to try to have all the info you need. But it still gives you all those things. You know, it gives you powers and abilities and spells. Yeah.
I think Thomas has really enjoyed the spellcasting mechanics and the idea of, like, as long as I don't roll poorly, I can cast this an infinite amount of times. But there's always that tension of, like, oh, geez, I hope this works. And then, like, you say you want to cast a spell, but you realize it's like, if this spell fails and we don't have the rest of the adventure, we're actually screwed. So I really hope that this one time doesn't really inconvenience the rest of the adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and then
so I would say like that's been my favorite part so far. It's just this roll for spells. Although it gets to a point where if you have a really good modifier, then the roll almost doesn't matter. Like, oh, I need an 8 or better. I only have a plus 7. It's like, oh.
Yeah, okay, it's an interesting thing because it can become hard to fail at the spell, although higher tier spells you can fail at, right? Because you have to,
right?
Because the challenge level increases. So as you try to do more powerful magic, the more powerful you become, the more risk you take. But then lower level magic, it's not as hard, but you have an equal 5% chance of like accidentally casting fireball on everyone or right, whatever it yeah. is, it exploding or whatever. But that's very uncommon. I think sometimes when you hear that about Dungeon Crawl Classics or Shadow Dark, it sounds really unfun. Like, oh God, I don't want that to happen. And that's true, but it happens so rarely. I mean, I don't...
We still haven't had a crit fail on a spell yet like,
I think,
in our game.
I think I have.
Yeah, you did once, that's true.
But I was a priest.
As a cleric, yeah.
So I had to atone.
Yeah.
But no, there's been no wizard crit fail, yeah, so far.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Which is good. But that,
but that just goes to show how rare that is.
Right.
In Dungeon Crawl Classics, they're so flavorful that... they're very rare, and after a while, you're like, oh, I kind of want to see one. I mean,
yeah. like, fudge your dice to crit fail. Yeah. Whoops.
Yeah. Okay, so you're also making a homebrew system. Why would you make? Mm-hmm. Why would you do that? Why
yeah,
would you?
Good question.
You got so many systems out there. Yeah.
There are so many. I think it goes, well, two reasons. First reason is because I want to. Mm. I think that's the only reason you really ever need. But I enjoy homebrewing. I've always enjoyed homebrewing. And there's something about a game that brings with it an ethos, right? Like old school D&D is you want gold, and gold is everything, right? You're willing to risk your life for gold. Well, like, for me, philosophically, like, the when I look at that, I'm like, well, that doesn't... There's nothing really great about that. Like, there's nothing, like, virtuous about seeking gold. That is a very selfish endeavor. And I have an ethos that I want to bring forth and portray, and, like, this is this world, and, like, my world is based on this karmic response of the gods, and, like, the more good you do... The more good happens in the world, the more bad you do, the more bad happens in the world. And because in an ideal place, like, you know, that's the way it should work, right? To me, anyway, that's what I think. And that's maybe a little personal, but what I'm bringing forth is this idea of goodness and, like, what I want players to act good. Like, to be a good person and you get rewards. Well, I kind of need to build a whole system around that. You know, you build a system around... being heroic, and there are other games where you surely want to be virtuous, right? And a game that comes to mind is like the Pendragon, right? Where you're like this deedly knight, but the game doesn't really reward you for being chivalrous or whatever. It's a totally different type of game, and that's more about lineage, and your whole goal is like to bring forth and bear forth a greater vast kingdom in the future, right? That's so like a game brings forth with it mentality and philosophy with it, and I'm kind of starting with the philosophy and kind of building the game around it.
Yeah,
and like adding pieces to it that make sense to me. And the end of it, it's going to be an RPG that's fairly similar to every other RPG I like. I like rules light games, and so I even started with a solo game zine, the Lone Spelunker, solo game called Dungeon Hero, I guess. It's a very generic name, but this little zine system where you have write-in attributes with D6, D8, D10, D12. Like, it's very similar. You roll that versus a different challenge die, and that's your result. And that to me was just so simple of a tool to take that and build the rest of everything I want to add to it into it, became the game that it is now. And the game it is now is really, really just about that and adding in like the gods to it. So like I'll have players roll for what race they are. And this game is called Cultures, but that's not relevant. What's relevant is the fact that like after you roll what type of creature you are, you roll when you were born, and it assigns a zodiac to you, and the zodiac gives you a certain benefit. Kind of think of like the standing stones in Skyrim, like you have this different
attribute.
That's
exactly what I thought of when you said it, yeah.
Yeah, so like you have this sign that you're established under like a zodiac, and then you have your class that you get to pick, but if you're a spellcaster, only wizard gets to pick their spell. Every other spellcaster gets a random spell, because I like to think of magic as a chaotic force. But then a lot of your attributes, a lot of the signs, the zodiac abilities, they only work if you have a certain number of karma. So at the beginning of the game, you will roll a d6 and you gain that many karma. At the end of the game, whatever karma you still have is your XP that you earned. So it's a really weird thing where you get the XP at the beginning of the game, and you can spend that XP to directly affect the world at the time, or you can save it to level up and make your character more powerful for the future. But yeah, the abilities are based off of like how much karma you have. Like certain ones can only activate if you have three or more. Certain ones you have to actually spend it to activate it. But yeah, all that is kind of contained in this idea of like karma being important, this pantheon being involved in the world, and being a good character should be rewarding.
That's nice. Could you say those three again? I feel like this is yeah. Say that again. Those three.
I don't remember what they were. So the gods are involved. Karma is powerful, and being a good person should be rewarding. I think that's what it is.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard that called recently the implied procedure. So, for example, in Shadow Dark, what is Shadow Dark? And it's so fun. It's so fun, the chaos and discord. It shouldn't be fun, but it is for me. That like answering questions like what is Shadow Dark, and there are a lot of wrong answers. That's fun to me, you know, you got like is Shadow Dark. I've heard it said it's a 5e that's BXified, and then I've heard it's BX, but it's 5eified, and I've heard it's DCC light, and I've heard all, you know, and I've at various times thought that, and all those are actually wrong, and it tells you what it is. But it has rules like that, right? It has like a range of bonuses on 6 stats. You roll 3d6 and you can have between a 3 and an 18. And depending on that bell curve, you can have, you know, between a -4 and a +4 or something like that. And you can have advantage, disadvantage. And these are these mechanical rules. But I've heard it said... Let me find this here. Game Master Core Ethos used the word ethos. That really, if you want to run Shadow Dark, it has a page here and it says, these are the core principles. Time. This is the most important resource. It must haunt the characters, every decision. Darkness. Respect the darkness. Nothing must make prized tools obsolete. That is to say, at no point should torches become irrelevant. Gear. Precious. Limited. Give value and utility to every single item. Action economy. One action. Make it count. Skip the boring stuff. These aren't mechanical rules. I've heard this called the implied procedure. And some would say this is the actual game. This is the actual rules of the game. And if you can do that, you actually are doing the game, you know. And so that's, I think, very true of a good game, is when it has, I know what I want to do. I want to do these four things, you know.
And that's why I have to homebrew, because I couldn't find a game that had those same things that I thought.
Well, I got to tell you, I've gotten to dabble in your homebrew game, and I've played a lot of TTRPGs, and I also am not aware of any game that captures your setting. It's very unique, and I've every once in a while I'll uncover something really specific and I'll be like, oh, Jake, this might be something. Oh, you know, but like, as if I'm like, you know, digging for the ancient Dead Sea Scrolls or something to try to find something that might apply to Mythic Isles. But man,
yeah,
even then, it's only a rough comparison. I've definitely never found it, so it makes sense to me why you would do it.
Yeah, and it's just a lot of fun too. And as you go, like as I've been going, like defining what's important, it like, and I've heard this said about a couple different games, is like the bric-a-brac and like the gear that you have can also define the setting, right? So like, because you have a laser pistol in your pocket, that defines where you are, right? Because you're not gonna have a laser pistol pocket when you're fighting Robin Hood, right? So like, the what you have is important. And I find myself adding rules for flavors of cake, and I'm like, why is this important? Like, why does adding salt give you +3 stamina to your, you know, like, it's very simulationist in that way, but at the same time, weapons are not, so the weapons are very, like, generic, and like, oh, this is a sword, and there's not, like, a bastard sword, or a long sword, or a short sword. No, it's just, it's a sword, so you can, you know, make it whatever kind of sword you want, so it doesn't really matter. Like, why is my food so granular and then my weapons so basic? Well, that's what's important, and it should reinforce the idea of what's important in the world, like make the world feel tangible and real, and you know, if a sword is important to you as a player, then I don't need to tell you that as you know, as a game, that you already accept that, like, you know what I mean? I don't need to tell you what's important if you already think it's important. I need to tell you what's not important is important also. I think that's kind of where I'm coming at it. And, you know, I don't know, there's little things that I like to change and make unique. Like, the first time I would consider this the 2.0 version of this homebrew game I've been making. The first version, there were no hit points. It used a stamina system like Troika, where you have a certain amount of stamina, and then, you know, you burn through your stamina, then you can't act anymore, and thus your character is inactive / dead. I had that, but then I also added this health track, and the health track was basically 6 spaces. You could think of it like spaces on a board game, like Monopoly, or around the 6 spaces. 6 spaces. The first one is you're fine. Second one, there's really no effect. The third one, you have a minor penalty. Fourth one, you have a major penalty. Fifth one, you're incapacitated. Sixth one, you're dead. And that was this like condition tracker basically. So I liked that, but it also didn't feel granular enough. So I added hit points back in. So now I have hit points again, but I'm keeping this health track too. But now it's a really cool effect because as a player, if you are being attacked by a monster. And I'm sorry if I'm getting rambly about my game, but if you're being attacked by a monster in this game, you know, it's your dice versus their dice. It's always a roll off in this game, which is fun. But if you lose the roll, whatever the difference is done to damage to you. Well, say if it's a super powerful monster, say they did 12 damage to you. Well, if you're a level 1 character and you only have 8 hit points, they did 12 damage to you. Oh no, I would die. Instead of, you know, subtracting all those hit points, you can just move 1 space on your health track. So you can basically think of it as super hit points. So yeah. You basically have 6. You have 6 super hit points instead.
Warhammer, however, does that. Warhammer, you have wounds, and then once you end that and enter a threshold, you go into a damage, like a track or a threshold, and it has an effect. All right, you're in the first category. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're in the second category now, you know, so on and so forth. But, yeah.
Right, and then as a player, you can decide when you want to use your hit points or your health track, right? So even if you just took 3 damage, if you have 25 hit points, you took 3 damage, you can, instead of subtracting those 3 hit points, just go down 1 space on your health track, because it's up to you when you do that. And then certain characters, like the warrior, has abilities to directly affect their health track, like they can go up the health track and heal themselves in that way, but meanwhile, healing spells actually only affect hit points, so like there's different minutiae within the game that make it interesting. But what makes it super interesting is I can take monster design, and monsters can have different numbers of health track or hit points. So like a goblin has 3 hit points, right? But a boggle, which is a very similar monster, has no hit points but has 3 health bases. So in that way, a goblin can only take a certain amount of damage. Meanwhile, a boggle might be able to take one huge hit from a monster and still be perfectly fine. So, or from a player character, it'd be fine. But that, I think that's really interesting is the design space there of making something granular versus narratively impactful, I think is really interesting.
Cool. When's it going to hit Kickstarter? When are you going to launch?
Yeah, good question. Let's see how playtesting goes.
You got to playtest this thing first. So you're going to start to playtest next week, right?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. I look forward to hearing how it goes. Hopefully you'll let me hop in every once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, if you can, then yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Hopefully you can too.
Yeah. All right, so what about, like, are there games or campaigns that you're like, someday I'm going to do this campaign? Like,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Someday I'd like to run, a game that's published by myself. I think that would be really cool.
That's cool.
I think actually someday I would like to be a player and have you run my game for me.
That's like I publish a thing, I purchase the thing, and then I run the thing. That's an interesting inception.
That is the goal. In fact, I'd probably even send you a free copy if you would agree to run it for me. I think that's how I would be. But yeah, what about you?
I have so many all the time. Somebody had mentioned that in the Facebook group. They were like, what if you get distracted and you have something else you want to do? And I'm like, I'm running games. I have I imagined this Traveler game 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I knew what I wanted to do. It's not unfolding the way I expected, but I knew I...
Does the game ever do that, though?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, every now and then, a game will be that's what I knew going in it was going to be, and that's what it was, and nice. I'm like, that was cool, but yeah, sometimes something will be very unexpected. The two big dang D&D things I got going on, I had two big campaigns, and there were two big sandboxes. I had Old School Essentials, which was set in the Vale, and it was the follow-on campaign to our big campaign, and then I had Otherworld. And I had opposite expectations of what those two games were going to be. I thought the Vale one was going to be this big kind of sprawling story with a bunch of investment and everything, and it turned out to be much more picaresque and something completely different than what I thought it would be. And the Otherworld game was meant to be open table, and I never expected anyone to get past level one. And now here they have got a dedicated group a year and a half in, and they're like, it's like our favorite game, and we love playing it, and we're having, all the players are super invested, and I did not think that was going to be that game. Well, anyways, I knew I wanted Firefly years ago, and I thought maybe it would be the actual Firefly RPG, because there is one. I used to listen to a Firefly RPG podcast. And then I thought it would be 5th edition, actually. And I tried. I tried to make that work. And then I thought it would be Stars Without Number. And then I thought it would be... And it didn't work out. And I really hesitated on Traveler for years. Because I was aware of Traveler. But I was intimidated by it. And this past year, I was like, I'm doing it. I'm taking the risk.
Right.
And I made huge mistakes. And... really big mistakes. There were some players that walked away from the game and all kinds of stuff. But we got through turbulent waters with it, and I'm having a good time with it now. And if we ended it next week, it'll have been 6 months of Firefly, is the way I look at it. So, but as far as even now, while I'm having this dream game that I wanted years ago, I'm already thinking, the Vale was this big Lord of the Rings style epic campaign, and I was ready to set that aside for a long time. By the time we got done, I was like, no more epic games for a while. Well, hey, someday I want to have another epic campaign with players that are super invested in the story, and they have characters they care about, and we're really rolling our sleeves up for an epic thing where they're the heroes, and I have like these different games I'm kind of like watching to see which one that's going to be, you know. And someday, you know, maybe 2 years from now or something, I bet that'll happen. There'll be some, the epic campaign will come to be, and it'll be in some way that I don't expect. But the post-apocalyptic campaign I wanted didn't quite work out. It wasn't anybody's fault. Some of the players, actually about half the players, couldn't end up playing. That really took the wind out of my sails. You know, when that happens, you want to play with somebody, and then they can't play.
Right.
So, and then when we started playing, and other players, it was very patchwork on this player couldn't be here then, and that player couldn't be there then. So, you know, we had 4 sessions. I had fun. And it was very cool. Mutineer Zero is very cool. And we just ended it after 4 sessions. So somewhere out there in the future is going to be a post-apocalyptic campaign I want to do. And I don't know what that's going to be yet. But
yeah, I still want to return to Fallout because I have my little Fallout project I was working on. But before we get into that, I was going to say, if you don't mind, like, what was it that you flubbed up about when it came to Traveler? Like, what did you get wrong? Did you misunderstand procedures? Did you misunderstand the ethos? Did you misunderstand, like, what happened?
All those things. Okay, so
so I thought I was playing Traveler, but it's actually some knockoff version called Trappler with a B,
so,
and I was confused about it.
Yeah, I bit off way more than I could chew. Way more. And here's what I mean. I ran 2 groups simultaneously. That's the number one thing. Like, and you'd be like, Ross, why would you do that? And you're right. That's crazy. I retrofitted a modern module to an old school game, and I got spoiled by modules. Like, I got spoiled by things that are made by Gavin Norman. Like, you can take an adventure by Gavin Norman, like Hole in the Oak or Winter's Daughter, and you don't even have to read it if you don't want to. Like, you can skim over it once maybe, but then you can put it down, and it's designed in such a way that it's for the game master, and you don't even have to really read the adventure. Well, it turns out I picked an adventure that you really need to read, and I didn't know that until I was already in it. And if I could go back and do it over again, I would have just thrown that adventure right out real fast and started over. I'd be like, never mind, sorry, wrong call on that. So I was running a frankly bad adventure. Sorry, frankly it was. I was starting a new game system amidst all this. So not only Traveler, but the 1977 version. And I was trying to understand it. I did not have the fictional knowledge. What I mean is, if you say, hey, Ross, right here and right now, walk me through a solo fantasy adventure using Dungeons and Dragons off the top of your head, I can. I can be like,
right.
You know, you're in a medieval fantasy tavern, and there's 4 tables and a burly tavern keep behind the bar is cleaning and watching as it looks like there's a table across from you where a group of adventurers themselves look as if they're getting quite rowdy. And you see one, and I'm just making all this up, like whatever, you know, like I've done that so much. And Dungeons and Dragons is at least easy in that you have walls and ceilings and doors and forests. You have a terrestrial experience that we experience day to day. How long does it take you to travel 400 feet? How long does it take you to travel 30 feet? We do that every day, right?
Right.
And now I've got space. How long does it take you to travel 50 million kilometers at 9.82 meters per second squared? What happens once you get within 3, you know, diameters of a planet? What effect will the gravity have on you? How fast will that gravity increase? Can you use it? What if it has a moon? How many, if you have a solar system what happens if you get close to a gas giant? What happens if you get close to a gas giant and the ship depressurizes, or you get exposed to a vacuum? What if, like, all these kind of things? We don't. That's not a part of our daily experience. So, like, it's right. not. So, if you're not deeply kind of like into that fiction, and that's kind of the difference between Star Wars and Traveler, is Traveler, you have certain distances at certain rates at certain times. And, you know, and gravity does things and planets do things and radiation does things and stuff like that. Science fiction. Well, anyways, all of that happened. And on top of all that, I picked a crew of complete strangers all to play together, half of whom had never played an RPG or had never played an old school science fiction RPG. That was way too much, Ross. Like, pick one or two of those things.
those seven fingers you were holding up, that's a lot of things.
That's a lot of things. Like, you know, pick a new RPG, but do it with some experienced people, or do something you're comfortable with and do it for some new people or something. But, yeah, I did all those things at once, and we still had fun, but it had some hiccups, and some of those players left and shuffled out, and we kind of pared it down to one group, and I worked hard. I worked hard to understand science fiction. I've read a bunch of pulp sci-fi. Like, I'd never read. Mm-hmm. I like Golden Age sci-fi, like The Foundation, like Isaac Asimov and Space Odyssey, Arthur C. Clarke and Robert Heinlein. And I really enjoyed Orson Scott Card as a kid, Ender's Game. But I had never read pulp or space opera. So I read Space Viking to try to understand what Traveler was supposed to be. And I'm still on that journey, and that journey's fun. You know, the players that are in it now, I had a conversation where we kind of recaged after those two groups, half of one group and half of the other group stuck with me. And those people came together into one group. And I said, all right, here's what I want to do. You know, are you on board with being Firefly? Like, you know, you're going to be trying to outrun your debt, and you're trying to gonna just keep flying one more day. Are you sure you want to do that? And everybody's like, yep, I'm down. And it's been great. But I've learned a lot about, like, groups and people and tabletop, and it's been a lot of learning. In 6 months.
Have you learned about the sci-fi stuff yet? Like, have you learned your math and your spaces and how much gravity affects stuff and what your percentages are?
Yeah, man.
Like, do you have those tables ready now?
Yeah, dude. I really like it. I nerd out on it. And so to me, it's a lot of fun because, so here's the infamous, you know, the table for Flip and Burn.
Nice.
Or the formula. I use this table and I interpolate. So, you know, if you want to, they always travel at 1G because their drive thrust provides 1G of thrust. So at 1G, it'll say, all right, your typical distance to the closest gas giant is 600 million kilometers. So from the arrival planet, 600 million kilometers at 1G, it takes 136 hours. And in 136 hours... You know, 136 hours is, that is about 5 days, five days and change. In 5 days, you will roll for a space encounter once per day. And the space encounter will be another starship, which might be outside their sensors. It's very much submarine. It's like The Expanse. So it's like, hey, you've got a ship coming up on your sensors. What do you do? And it's very tense. And, it's a lot of fun to me. Like, where you appear in the solar system, how can you use that to your advantage? What happens when you fail? Hey, you appeared 5 days out. Okay, we got to travel for 5 days. What are we going to do? Are we going to, like, try to go silent? Are we going to try to get somebody's attention? How are we going to try to... They've come up with all kinds of schemes at times to try to trick people. They tricked a pirate vessel into believing that they were an advanced scout for an arriving fleet.
Nice.
Yeah. They've outrun pirates. They've deorbited. They've done like an emergency an entry into an atmosphere in order to occlude a attacking ship's sensors from being able to catch them. And then they went nap of the earth and hit the deck on you know, for the planet. And this is all tied to this math, you know, and it feels like the Expanse. Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah, the Expanse is one of my only real experiences with sci-fi. I think the only thing
hard sci-fi.
That hard sci-fi.
So
like
me
the
too.
The only thing that would predate that for me, it's not even that hard sci-fi, but Star Trek: Next Generation. My dad was really into Star Trek: Next Generation, so like that, watching that growing up was fun. But to me, the Expanse is closest to what the Traveler experiences, I think, as far as like what I am exposed to. But I think it's funny that there was that disjoint between your expectation and like what the game came out to be, and then like having to go and verse yourself in the archives of what is pulp and what is the ethos that this game, you know, presents itself, and am I understanding this right? And like this idea of like study. I need to properly understand this. Like, what is this? That to me is really interesting. Having to go and do the archives.
That to me is true of original D&D. To me, to present a game of original D&D, to me is more about understanding sword and sorcery and pulp fantasy than it is about some specific mechanic. Because on the character facing end, the mechanics are really thin. There's not a lot there. There are world procedures, but in my opinion, they're just not that different among various modes of classic D&D. If you know one form of classic D&D, I feel like it will at least work. I don't know, maybe people disagree, but to me, the big difference with original D&D is it's bound to that fiction, which is kind of what you were saying about your world. You're like, this game needs to be about this world. And I observe that when that happens, games do really well. So, like Dungeon Crawl Classics you mentioned, to me, that game is entirely about attaining a vibe. Like,
right.
It gets this vibe that it wants. And if you are in that vibe, my saying about Dungeon Crawl Classics is you can't play it and not have fun. If you're in that vibe. If you're not in that vibe, you might hate it. And I think that's true of original Dungeons & Dragons, too. Like, if you get that source literature, becoming microscopic and jumping into a mushroom is really cool. While you're running from a purple worm. It all comes together really well.
I think that comes out of any game, though. If you're not vibing with the vibe, then you're not going to have fun. But if you are, then you will. Like,
well, some games lack a vibe.
I think anymore games enforce vibes more than most things. Like, it might just be a vibe with no game. I think, like, that's to me, I think, is a lot of, like, okay, so like Morkborg, like this apocalyptic game, right? And then you have Pirate Borg, which is like just spicy flavor of pirates, right? And like the whole game just oozes pirates. So like, to me, that's what most games are to me nowadays, is there more
in the indie
flavor
world.
Right, more flavor and less game to me, I think.
Yeah, in the indie world for sure. They're trying to get across it's interesting, and the origin for a lot of these indie games was basic and expert Dungeons and Dragons, and I think that was something that really set that game apart. And to me, I've mentioned these two DNA strands of original D&D and basic D&D. And basic D&D was intended initially just to be basic, just to get you onboarded. But original D&D was always intended to be a very fleshed out game system. It was always intended to be full of rules, like tonight, the one I pointed out, where you have a 0.013% chance of dying of pneumonia once per week in a cold climate. But in basic D&D, in the second page, Tom Moldvay says, hey, these rules are not so much about rules. They maybe should just be called suggestions, actually. And there are two things that Tom Moldvay says that I think really nails it. One of the things he says is, he's like, that doesn't mean, because this is the misunderstanding when people hear rulings over rules, it doesn't mean these rules don't matter. These rules have been play-tested. They're very thoroughly play-tested and well thought out, and they'll work very well, and they'll give you what you need. They're not bad rules. But how you employ the rules is way more important. That is what this game is about. That's what Tom Moldvay says in the basic set. And games like EZD6, to me, very much are strongly saying, this is how you do this game. This is about, this is a style, a vibe, this is a method, that is more important than knowing that you add a D6 when you do this or that, you know?
And right. Yeah.
That's true of like ICRPG, I think.
Yeah,
like,
that's what I was about to say. Yeah,
you look at ICRPG, and I ran an experiment that went very, it went okay, but ICRPG by my experiment wasn't very fun. And the reason, I think, is because I ran it almost textbook. And I think that the whole book was needed. The whole book saying, hey, this is like a way, a zen of a game.
A mantra, yeah.
This isn't just like a bunch of use a D4 for this and use a D12 for magic. That wasn't the point, yeah.
You think that should be the way a game is? You know, like, should a game be a philosophy? Should a game be more than a rule set? Does a game benefit by being more than a rule set? Or can a game be just a rule set that you can apply different things to? Like, I think GURPS is the most generic, that there is no philosophy here, we are game. Like, I think that's what GURPS is. But there aren't a lot of other examples of that, you know what I mean? I think most games have an ethos and have this philosophy they bring with it. You think that's beneficial to have an ethos?
Well, there's a schism in the OSR between, and I'll use what a modern kind of audience uses, although the terms are not agreed upon in the schism, where you have like what I used to call just old school. It's sometimes called classical gaming. Sometimes it's called fantasy adventure gaming. Sometimes people call it classical adventure gaming. And then you have what I would call old school renaissance, which would be things like Pirate Borg and Morkborg and Knave and, you know, Troika would fit under that, you know. And other people would call that new SR or, you know, post-OSR. I've heard different things. And I mentioned these kind of two schools, these two styles, because that is a major break you're describing. Because if you are a classical adventure gamer, you are playing a game. And that's very important. That's very important for the experience. It has rules. The rules matter. They mechanically matter. And that will produce a very special experience. It'll create a special, you mentioned simulation. And classical adventure gamers can get a sense of appreciation of something real and imaginative by adhering to the rules and understanding them, and they work well. And that's different, in my opinion, than a OSR gamer who uses something like Pirate Borg or Morkborg, because they took that, to me, is the Renaissance. Tom Moldvay was saying, hey, we're just trying to, you're an 11-year-old boy, we're just trying to get you going here, so here's something really simple. And a bunch of like modern hipsters like me took that and was like, what if we just made that our entire ethos of gameplay? And so I just point that out to say that there are people that play RPGs that care about the rules for good reasons.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I just didn't know what the benefit is to including versus excluding the ethos itself, and like this philosophy that goes with it.
Yeah, I think it's because in these older games, or in games that are more simulationist in character, you can appreciate the descent into a secondary reality in a way that you cannot do if you don't have the possibility of a 0.015% chance of dying of pneumonia in cold conditions once per week. If you don't have that, you can't appreciate the unseen effect a year later in gameplay when you've all deeply invested in this and you have seen this world come to be. That's not on offer when you play Morkborg. And that's okay. And people that are, and this is something I try to explain to those people all the time, is that people that are playing Shadow Dark are not trying to play Advanced Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
So
yeah.
So there's, it's a silly comparison because they're two different goals. So
well, that makes sense. I would say that I would say what I mean to say is chess has no philosophy behind it, right? It's a strategy game. It's pretty abstract in that way. Although there, you could add one to it, right? You could add, this is, you know, one kingdom versus another. You could add narrative and nuance to it. But by itself, it has nothing. Whereas heavy Euro games, which have all of these components and pieces and rules and cards and decks of cards and all these different pieces, these heavy Euro games are, they also sometimes have no narrative. They have their own, abstract, you know, strategy game. So yeah. Like both of those are strategy games on different, totally different spectrums of tabletop gaming. And I think RPGs often have, you know, a narrative attached to it, and very mm-hmm. seldomly don't have one attached to it.
Yeah, but in the early days, Gary Gygax had a word for that, which some people have called the Arnesonian style of play. I don't know if this is a fair kind of a fair way to categorize this, of Gygaxian versus Arnesonian, but you know, Gary Gygax, he created Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. It had all sorts of rules, and he was a war gamer. And he was very much into creating all kinds of rules. Rules for nautical stuff and all these minute features of nautical stuff. And, you know, and it fills pages upon pages. And then Dave Arneson is like, I don't know, I'll just make it up. Now, that it was true. That they did those things that way. Gary Gygax believed in math. He believed in things working a certain way. He was a naturalist. He believed that the world worked a certain way. And Dave Arneson was just like, roll 2d6 and get a 6, you know, and that's it. And that was Dave Arneson. So yeah. Gary Gygax at one point would call that a non-game. He would suggest that's not a game anymore. Now, I don't know I don't know that he would define it. He had it some, once he started becoming more of a business leader and a brand leader, he would start to define, he would use epithets for it that were insulting and stuff. Some people would say, would actually define all games that are based on an ethos, as you're describing. Some people would say they are not role-playing games. They would say they are story games. And they would say a story game is not just from that Forge school of thought where you have Powered by the Apocalypse, but a game wherein you are trying to craft a creative project. You're trying to, whether it's emerging or not, you're hoping to get a story out of it. Modern role-playing games, some people would call those story games. They'd say that's the goal of those things, and that's different than some of this classical model where you just have a world. You right. just have the thing, and if a story comes out of that, that's cool. But you could also not have a story at all come out of it, and you'd still appreciate it. We're in the weeds a little bit. 99% of the hobby probably is in that camp of, we want a narrative. Whether that narrative emerges or whether we inject it, we want to have it. And I just want to point that out to say that actually you don't have to have that. You can, yeah, you can have a game full of rules.
Let me rephrase the question then. Do you prefer a game that has a heavy narrative, or do you prefer a game that lets you discover that narrative through the procedure and through the rules?
Yeah, I definitely prefer the latter. Yeah. But I think something that maybe makes me different than the classical crowd is I want that narrative then to emerge. I'm there to have that unexpected narrative emerge out of that. But so I carry that kind of modern desire into that. I just want a secondary world to be there, and I want to go travel it with my friends.
I agree.
And there may not be a story that comes out of that.
That's true.
In the sense of, like, we sit together, the mountain and I. You know, like, you're just there, you know, and that may happen. Sure, having a story is cool, and honestly, it's kind of weird to me the idea that a story won't come out of it. It invariably does.
I think what's different about a game that is game based and percentile based or procedurally based is the game is almost defined before you play it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
There's the input is already decided, so the output is all that's left to be discovered. But of course there's also endless variables therein. So I find it very interesting to have, you know, a game that has those things been decided before you roll, and that's still intriguing. I don't know. It's funny to think, like, this has already been decided. What is your fate?
Yeah.
That to me
input randomness versus output randomness. So, like, there's structures that are like, we know exactly how it's going to go into this. We have no idea what's going to come out of it. And then you have... there are actual RPGs that invert that, and it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And they say, we will have the story, and we already know what it is. We just don't know how we're going to get there. And that is like a school of thought. It's, yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like a great way to make a murder mystery game. Like a noir murder mystery, you know, pulpy detective work game where you start with the... murder scene, and like it's already been decided, but like, how did this happen? And you get backwards from there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I'll just go ahead and start making that real quick. I'm
just kidding. Yeah. Just that, you know, Candela Obscura, you know, you do actually need to have something players can do.
Shots fired.
You can't just like publish art and not have anything. Now, people make that accusation about Morkborg, and it's, you know, and it's true. That's an interesting thing. Like, that's kind of what we're talking about is can you just have a vibe? Could you just have like an art book? Because some people hate that art punk thing. But the funny thing about Morkborg is, see, I love one page rules. I love FKR kind of play. My aspiration is for that to be my gameplay. Eventually, like, I don't need no system. Where we're going, we don't need systems. eventually. But
the pinnacle of that is the worm game. I can't remember what that game was called.
It just has one word. It just says squirm. That's it.
So it's writhe. Yeah, writhe. Yeah.
We are but worms.
We are but worms. Right. Yeah, that's great. That's. I don't know. It's so interesting. I think it's funny that people don't like the art deco stuff, like the art punk stuff. I think that's really super... to me, that's most inspirational. Like,
yeah, I mean, I love it, obviously.
It's definitely sets my heart on fire to see a good piece of art. Like, now I'm excited about this game. Like, I don't think I need the rules because I guess I am kind of Arisonian in that way where I just... I can make up a rule that sounds fair to me, and that's me too, is I can discuss that with my player.
Yeah.
You know, I think this is a 5 and 6, and then they say, but well, I have this one feat. Like, oh yeah, you're right. It's a 4 and 6. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got this.
Jim Parkin would suggest that actual game prep and rules is if you want to prep for a Star Wars game, just watch Star Wars. And then, like, riff off.
Now you know.
And now you know. And he would also suggest that the human mind represents a greater computational power of random or varying inputs, such that dice are not required. I don't want to say that they're useless or bad. That's not true, and I don't think he would say that. But he would say, like, the great power of calculation is to present the situation and what's going to come out of that. That alone is more powerful than a die. And you almost just have that plus go watch the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. For me, the biggest importance of the die is it helps me solidify things that I'm uncertain about. In fact, I believe I heard you mentioned this on the podcast before, but or maybe it was your guest, but like sometimes you just roll the die so that you know whether or not you actually like that outcome or not. You know what I mean? You roll behind a screen and like, this, why am I rolling this? Oh, because I think this might happen. Oh, this rolled and now I don't like that result, but I wouldn't have known that I didn't like that result until I rolled that result.
Interesting.
And now I know that I don't like that result. I think that's kind of an interesting thing to use dice for, is to help you make up your mind on certain stuff. And now you have this thing that says, ah, but the monster's not here. And that's something that you wouldn't have decided for yourself, because why would the monster not be there, right? But now that it is not there, then it lets you run with that. And you're like, okay, well, now the monster's not here. So that means, well, if the monster's not here, that means it's probably hunting, which means that this is the, I mean, like, it just, it informs so much about the world because you rolled the dang die.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, before, if you had it your way, the monster would have been there, and then the world says nothing about that. But
yeah, another thing Jim Parkin would say is, it's not that there were too many options, and he wants fewer options, and he wants something simpler. It was the opposite. He played Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, and he wants to be Macho Man Randy Savage. And it's not in the book.
There's no feats
and
for that.
There's no feats for that. And a Dungeon Master would say that. He'd be like, well, we can kind of make a fighter, and then, but you can't really do this. And so it's actually that it restricts that infinity. That's why he just doesn't want to be. And then he would use terms like common sense, which is what you're describing, which is like, why would a monster be there? You know, and if they would be there, why would they be there? Instead of always tying a monster to, well, you've moved 240 feet three times, so ergo 30 minutes must have passed, therefore 1 in 6 chance of a monster. Now, again, I love that. I love doing that.
Yeah.
So don't get me wrong, but I get it. But
I also would want to play in a game where it's like, because obviously this works better face to face, but like, you have a game where whenever a player takes a drink, that's an encounter roll. Like, just like random things like that. Like any type of social interaction. Like anytime a player looks at their phone, opens an encounter roll. Like anytime. Like, that's the kind of stuff that I would want to play. Like, if you're playing in like a public venue, anytime a stranger walks up to the table, that's an encounter roll. Like,
yeah.
No, I don't know.
So that's actually part of what you're talking about. Is like, I think right what you're talking about now is a game, not a story. It's a game, and that's fun. Like, it's just fun to play a game where it's a gameable element, and you're like, oh, somebody looked at their phone, you know, so now we're doing this thing, and yeah. That's not a story or a narrative anymore. That's a game, and that can be fun to do, is to just have a game, too. Yeah, so
I don't know, but you can always add the story back to it, too.
Yeah, it's like, true. You could. I can't remember the term for it, but you could just say that that's something that the gods do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. So,
I don't know. The fun circles you could run in.
Yeah.
Game versus narrative, and narrative that informs the game. And and rules yeah. them for them.
I'm having fun anyway. You know, the Shattered Ark does that. If you want to just mess with people, it has like a whole suite of tools for the game master to mess with lights and change times, and they agreed mm-hmm. time passes, so the encounter die is changed, and there's all these like things like that. I don't know. I love all this stuff. I love Ark Punk. I love Morkborg. I love that the actual rules fit on one sheet. And then, yeah. like, the rest is just, like, death metal art.
Yeah. Some of my favorite RPG stuff is the even RPG stuff. Like, some of my favorite...
Nice.
I have a book of myth and legends, which is Ooh. Just, you know, a compilation of different... myths and legends yeah. from all over the world, and that is one of my favorite things I have. And I also have a art book by Brian O'Connor, the Dracopedia, which is just an art
Ooh,
book about
cool.
this guy who's trying to describe to you how to paint and draw dragons. That's all it is. But there are these little bits of like world building in there that are really interesting, and it just makes my brain run wild about like, ooh, how does this work and what does that look like?
Yeah.
And, you know, how's the stuff go? Because if like someone's gonna put all that thought into the ecology of a dragon, then you could do the same thing with any other monster.
Yeah. Man, okay. To return to a previous topic, so you said like your favorite RPG books are not RPG books, and here's my crazy falling apart, falling in on itself shelf, where they're just a literal stack. The foundation of the shelf down here at the bottom has two compartments. One compartment is Lord of the Rings, and the other compartment is Star Wars. And that's like nice. The bottom of the shelf, and they're like Star Wars art books and novels and Lord of the Rings, stuff like that. And someday, I want to have the big dang Star Wars campaign. I've never had one. I want to have that Star Wars specifically. I want to have that someday. That'd be cool. Or like the Dollar General Star Wars, like the Star Wars I just make up, and it's totally Star Wars,
yeah.
but it's not.
I want to play that
one
game.
Of those two.
Dollar, sign me up for Dollar General
yeah.
Star Wars. That's the one I want to be.
Yeah, like where it's just made up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Spaceballs,
yeah,
like my version of Spaceballs.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. As long as it's not so punny, I'm in.
Yes.
If it's too punny, I start to lose interest because I'm like, I can't take this seriously. Nothing matters.
Yeah. And then the other one, I did get to do Dollar General Lord of the Rings, and I really loved it. It was one of my favorite campaigns. It is my favorite RPG, the Hero's Journey 2nd Edition. But someday I would like a Lord of the Rings campaign, a big dang Lord of the Rings campaign. And
nice.
I haven't had that. So I'd,
yes.
those are two aspirations.
They're good ones to have. I think it's funny that they're... aspirations of yours, and they're also like the foundation of your bookshelf. There's something
yeah.
like metaphorical. There's something very deep there. If you look at your bookshelf, which is literally collapsing, this bookshelf in Ross's room.
This is my life. This is a metaphor for my life.
It's just it's a frame of where you imagine a bookshelf being, and then the books are just stacked inside the bookshelf, just on top of each other. And
it's
so beautiful.
That.
I mean, they can see it.
Oh,
if they've seen the live plays, they've seen it.
That's
just
true.
There.
Oh, no. And my dog's bachelor pad. Oh, boy.
Oh.
Wait, who's that?
Torches for sale.
I probably can't afford them, though. I mean,
check your pockets.
You know,
check
like
your pockets. You got this.
I'm kind of tight on funds. Okay, I'll check my... No. Hey. I got enough for the inn tonight. I can pay for the tavern cast.
Only 2 copper a torch. They're on sale, folks. I gotta get rid of these torches. The first one's free.
I guess I can afford the torches.
So we're going? We're finally going?
All right. Yeah. Let's do it.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Let's do it. Mythic Mountains RPG is a private online play club that focuses on folk RPGs. Folk RPGs are the games that belong to all of us. They're what actually happens at a table between friends. It's their voice that has the authority on what is fun and what works for them. Weekly, we upload our games to allow others to sit in with us. The channel isn't monetized. We don't own the artwork, music, software, or games shown in these actual plays, and you can find links to their authors in the description. Like, subscribe, and share if you wish, or don't. Just like games in person, you're welcome to pull up a chair, sit in, and watch some of our games. No performances, no fancy equipment, just regular people playing folk pencil and paper role-playing games and having a good time. We hope these games will prove a source of enjoyment to anyone just wanting to listen in, anyone looking for examples of how actual groups run and play folk RPGs, and most importantly, if you haven't found your group yet, you're welcome here at ours.